options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. This is the fifth one. If you stayed with me five for five, we're on day two. I sincerely appreciate that. This one's going to be a beauty because I get to get coached, or at least I think Ryan Renteria has some thoughts on coaching. Ryan, welcome. It's been a long time since you and I have seen each other in person, but we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Keith. I've got a lot of respect for the positive impact that you're having in the post-hedge fund days, and really excited to dig in and help the audience however I can in terms of reducing stress without sacrificing performance. And hopefully people will see the lessons are relevant, whether you're running a large fund or leading a team of two.
I love that. His book, by the way, is called Lead Without Burnout. So watch for that in early looks coming to a theater near you, because I'll be quoting Renteria multiple times. I just want to take a step back, though, first and just kind of give people a sense of where you came from, because you really have had a transformative career. Again, we met on Wall Street. We didn't meet writing books.
Right. Yeah, well, happy to dig into that. I was raised by a single mom on a kindergarten teacher's salary in Sacramento. I went to a very violent public high school with a very high dropout rate, and I was the first guy in a long time to get into Stanford. And I really nearly had to drop out because I was so woefully unprepared. I didn't go to the fancier schools that others had. But I did survive and use that grit to push through, and I made it to Wall Street, and that's where we met. And I spent about a decade there, first at Goldman in equity research, and then I was at two hedge funds, Balyasny and Karsh. And I was very fortunate to have good numbers and achieve financial independence right as I was burning out. And I decided to completely walk away. And I feel like that decision has some important lessons for everyone. It was an amazing one for me because I've been blessed to have led a pretty good life since then. I've volunteered with several children's charities right after that. I spent 9 years as a Moneyball advisor to the Indiana Pacers, their coaching staff, their GMs. And now I've built this executive coaching business for CEOs and managing partners and senior investors. But there were also some flaws in that decision process, though I don't regret it and was the right one for me. I thought staying in that business would completely destroy my personal life, and I was wrong. 15 years ago, I just didn't have the lessons in work-life balance and leadership and things of that nature that I have today, and that's really what the focus of my coaching work is, and as well as the book that I've written, where I'm donating all the profits to mental health charities.
Love that. Mental health, big topic locally, as I'm sure you've heard. There's an organization called Shoulder Check. Shoulder Check by chance?
I have not heard of Shoulder Check.
So around what you'll see in New England prep school hockey now is if it's a game where they're acknowledging Shoulder Check, the foundation, it's a mental health foundation. All the hockey guys get around in a circle, which is atypical before a game, especially with the other team, and put their arms around each other. And the whole point is check in
right.
With your neighbor, with your teammate. Because you never know.
Right.
We can get into that, too. I want to take a step back. Obviously, we will get into that, obviously. But I want to take a step back and just, your point on, by the way, there's a reason why Renteria looks a lot better than I do right now. Like, there's a reason why his hair isn't white. It's a grind, man. It is a real grind. Karsh Capital, by the way, was literally the first revenue check that ever came into HedgEye. It's a thing. We have it.
And McGough is still there.
Yeah, it's all that happened. But man, can you kind of lift off where you were there and say, because you did interject that it isn't what you thought it was. You think that you could have survived it now that you know what you know. But tell people what that job felt like when you were burnt out.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, all aspects of my personal life were in the toilet. I was sleeping horrendously. Sometimes I'm covering international stocks and I'm setting my alarm for midnight and I wake up. And if the news is good and favorable to my position, then I can't get back to bed. I'm so excited. I want to see where the stock opens. And if it's bad news, I'm thinking, man, I'm about to have a horrendous day and it's midnight and I haven't gotten any sleep.
Yeah.
So the sleep is terrible. I really felt like I had no time to exercise. I remember my first year at Goldman Sachs, you had to use the gym once in order to keep with that. I think you had like a 9-month wait list to get to the gym. So we would go swipe our card, turn around and go right back to work just to keep our membership, which we never used. So exercise was very difficult. You're eating at your desk. You're not exactly ordering the healthiest things on earth. And I mean, forget about being present at home with loved ones. Your stocks are always on your mind. So it is a complete and utter grind. It is a brutal business. And I guess at that time I felt like, well, this is how it's always going to be. I have to walk away. And once again, I feel very blessed. It was a great decision for me. Life's been phenomenal. But I could have stayed in that business had I realized the things that I realize today. And I'm happy to get into sort of those things. But a lot of it has to do with the culture you create with your team, how you outsource, how you trust the A players you bring in, et cetera.
Well, you mentioned family. Now, that certainly resonates with me now, and it will resonate with the younger teammates that I have that are either just having their first child or about to. It is quite an experience to try to do this job and try to be even an average at best parent. I mean,
right.
If people think I'm bad at trying to coach how to play this game, you should try to tune in to me on parenting. Oh my, that would be bad, really bad. But correct me if I'm wrong, but in your book, you really have these three, you're like freedom, family time, and your health. Like those are three big things, that you should be focusing on, not one at a time, but together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really about, achieving a 10 out of 10 as a whole human. And so we have an exercise in the book called the Wheel of Life that's I've just tweaked. It was originally designed by, I think, your alma mater, somebody out of your alma mater many years ago. But what the problem is that most of us are perfectionists and we're trying to be a 10 out of 10 in every single area of life. Mm-hmm. And that is impossible. It's just a recipe for burnout. And so what happens is people naturally think, well, I'm going to default to work because I don't want to let my team down. I don't want to slip behind the competition. And so everything else suffers. And I truly believe that self-actualization comes from, can I be an 8 or 9 out of 10 in the 3 or 4 areas of life that matter the most to me? Mm-hmm. And that's really what a lot of my focus in the book is and a lot of my focus with coaching is. And I can tell you that the majority of CEOs that I coach are anywhere between 45 and 60. And it's a common theme over and over again. I wish I had more time with my kids. When I do, it's phenomenal. I want to be more present with them. I'm never going to get this time back. And so how do I realize that without slipping versus the competition, letting my team down and sacrificing my professional goals? And that's what the book and the coaching is all about.
Mm-hmm. When you, I guess there will be atypical experiences you have with an executive, and then there's kind of the typical, I guess, response. But what is it like when you 45 to say that's right squarely in my in my wheelhouse? I'm 49. I've seen a lot. If I actually don't ask for a lot of help on this because I wouldn't know who to ask. So I guess that's the point. Are you kind of like their shrink?
You're getting to one of the most important points is that CEOs, it's extraordinarily lonely at the top. You feel like you don't, your therapist might not have the business experience to understand. Your significant other may or may not, but you don't want your marriage to be entirely talking about your work. And you may fear looking weak in front of your investors, your board, or your team. And so this is why executive coaching is exploding, because there are very few trusted sounding boards out there that you can open up, be vulnerable, talk through these things, and get evidence-based counsel on how to improve some of these things.
I'm part of a, I shouldn't say I have no access. I mean, I'm part of, you're familiar with YPO, I assume?
Of course, yes.
So YPO, Young Presidents Organization, you have to be actually under the age of 50, which now I'm knocking on the door, so maybe they're going to kick me out. But what's super helpful there is what they call a forum, where you have, so I'm in a group with eight other founders, executives of their companies, and those companies have nothing to do with each other. They do that purposefully, so we're not just talking stocks in the meetings. But it's really like it's purely confidential. You can open up. You get to hear. And again, we hit on these big topics: your relationship with your spouse, right, your relationship with your children, your relationship with your business. How do you make it come together? That's been part of my solution. I've never, and many people bracing for it right now would say, I've been telling a lot of people would say that I need a therapist, right? But I've never had one for anything, you know, other than a physical therapist, I guess I've had that. But how do you get around people? Like, how do you get to somebody like me who's like probably a little stubborn on that level?
Sure. Well, you're a lifelong learner, right? So you're always trying to improve yourself, and you see it in the investing game. And it's really about helping the individual understand that nothing could be more important than improving from a leadership game, because that's actually going to take your EBITDA, your returns on capital higher. You're going to have more family time. You're going to be more relaxed, et cetera. And it's interesting that you brought up this forum, because I lived in New York City for 17 years. And when I moved my family back to my hometown of Sacramento 6 years ago, we were supposed to get an MLS team, and I was going to be one of the local owners. And at the breakfast, I met somebody who was one of the top businessmen in town, and he said, I recently started a forum. It's very much like YPO-EO, but we're independent. We're not affiliated with them, of 12 prominent CEOs in town, and we need a professional coach. And so I started working with them in that type of format that you're used to from YPO. And then over time, people felt like it was a phenomenal outlet, but they wanted more time than once a month. And then a number of them said, can you work with me one-on-one? And so that forum is phenomenal. I have a lot of experience with it. I still do it today. And I think that, again, it comes back to understanding that if you get help from somebody outside of your circle, because you cannot see things when you're too deep in your own weeds, it's just going to make both your business life and your personal life dramatically better.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the word would be separate. So let me ask this differently. Like, how do you go from fixing or helping Keith, the CEO, to helping him help his culture and creating what I think you call it a culture of well-being? And do you do it all at the same time, or do you separate the personal versus the strategies?
The second drives the first. And so it all starts with, how do you create a culture of well-being that attracts the most elite A players out there?
Okay.
That then you learn to trust and delegate to with autonomy and ownership of responsibilities, which frees up more of your time for two things. Number one, deep strategic thinking about where you want to take your business on a 5 to 10 year basis. What is the changes in technology and customer preferences, what geographies or markets might I want to go to? What do I need to do to take my EBITDA, my returns on capital higher on a 5 to 10 year basis? And number two, mental recharging and that time with family and friends and at the gym and eating properly. It's funny because people thought, oh, Lead Without Burnout is the title of your book. You're going to talk all about sleep and exercise and meditation. Well, everyone already knows that you need those things. It's how do you create the time for those things?
Yes.
And that's really what the book is about. It's about creating that culture that gets the elite A players in there and fired up and want to fight the world for you. And you're still in the trenches with them. You're still working hard, but you're spending more of your time on strategy, big picture thinking, and mentally refreshing yourself so that you're that best executive when you come in on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, separating those two things, even though they go together, on a personal level, I would say that the way I've solved partly for that, when people say, man, you read a book every 10 days, you've written 3,000 early looks, how the hell why aren't you 300 pounds and, you know, on the eve of your first heart attack? And I might be, but I'm not 300 pounds. And it's because my wife and I have essentially agreed to agree on a certain you know, organization of our day and of our week and of our month with our kids and our schedules, where I actually have time as soon as the market closes to not deal with family stresses, business stresses. It's my time with my dog. I used to run a lot with him. Now I can't run as much, so I run downhill and I walk up the hills. But, you know, that time is critical for me in the day, right? Because I have 12 hours that I'm grinding from 4:30 to 4:30, and then it's me and I love Boomer, but he's not going to talk back. He's not going to ask me questions. And I think if my wife and I didn't agree on that, like if I had a wife who's like, look, kids just got home from school. Giddy up there, buddy. You better be in it like I am on the weekends. I can't. I think that would take me right up.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between, with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Sure. Well, I think it's a great point. Cheers to you for creating that time and to have a very supportive wife and to work together to figure out what that right time is. For some people, it's the middle of the day, where after a certain amount of time, they feel burnt out, they need a refresh on productivity, and they may take an hour walk in nature. And first time you propose something like this, they think, are you crazy? But that's when you're getting some of your best deep strategic thinking time done, because you're not in the office and you're not getting hit with a bunch of emails and people walking in your office. For somebody like yourself that's bolted to the chair with the market hours, then post-market hours is the right time to do it. And so each person, based on their specific business that they're in, has to work out when they do that time, but creating that time and being present during that time is the most important thing. Coming home and seeing your kids and checking your phone every 5 minutes is not being present, and they recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Creating that for your team, Marina's on the board, Jenron's on the switch. Like, they have to be here because we're on live TV today. They can't go for a walk right now, right?
That's right.
But we don't have written rules here where, well, first of all, we have no vacation policy. Like, you take your vacations when you need them. You can leave the office whenever you want to go for a walk, and a lot of people do. Is that, like, we're a very unique culture. I get that. We're very flexible, and we love finding, in your definition, A players. And they get that. But, you know, how atypical is that in your findings, like, with all the people that you work with?
Yeah, it completely depends on the business, right? So I work with one CEO is a manufacturing business. Another one has distributes residential construction. And so those frontline jobs, you have to be there on the front line, right?
Yep.
Whereas maybe you have other roles that are more IT driven or tech driven that have some more flexibility and things of that nature. But I think the beautiful thing that's happening is over time, people realize there is a massive shortage of A player talent. And if you are going to beat your competition for that talent, particularly in a remote world where people aren't necessarily tied to certain cities, then you have to really figure out what is most important to that one individual that I'm currently interviewing to fulfill this role.
Yep.
And everyone has different levels of things that are important to them. And so understanding that is key to winning over that talent and beating your competition. And again, it's going to vary by the business and by the specific hour of the day.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about those A players? Like, I mean, can use whatever example obviously you want. I mean, you worked with the Pacers. I mean, at that level, or at my level, like the analog would be, I have X amount of analysts. There are A players, and there are players that want to be A players. There are players that could be A players. There are players that never will become A players. They tried, they failed, etc. Can you walk through how you would define both what an A player becomes and or what you're looking for that to happen?
Sure. And again, I think it varies by the role, but a lot of it and integrity and ethics is table stakes. Let's just get that out of the way. You never want a culture killer, no matter what. but I think there are a few characteristics.
You just wave that off. Like, that's the first thing that gets you out of here is if you're like that person. And it's bloody it's obvious. Sticks. It's like a black swan floating around the floor out there.
It's not worth it. Whether you're in the NBA or on Wall Street or running a manufacturer, it's just not worth it, right, to have somebody like that. So I think, you know, the whole premise of the book is being able to hire the A players that are lifelong learners. They crave autonomy, responsibility, ownership, and you want to be able to trust that you can delegate high-level responsibilities to them, and you don't have to continuously check in on them. And they can run with the first 90%, and it's on them to take good notes, to be detail-oriented, to be organized, and to stay on top of things, and know when to bring you in for the final 10% for you to see how their thought process is evolving, et cetera. So I think, you know, organization, attention to detail, lifelong learner, intellectual curiosity, somebody that's extraordinarily reliable. Those are all sort of core traits, no matter what the business that you're in. And then obviously there's going to be role specific traits. And I think a lot of it comes down to what people need to ask themselves is there are some people here that may be world-class investors. Are you world-class as a hirer? And every aspect of that process is so important, from the first impression you make, whether it's a written job description, or if you never write a job description and you're just asking contacts for references, having that unique selling proposition, because make no mistake, you are selling them on joining you. If they truly are an A player, they have a lot of choices and you're selling them on joining you. And then it's the unique interview questions and to make sure that it's just not, oh, this person had a great day and one person liked them. Do you have a quantitative system for rating them where these are the five things we're looking for? And they interviewed with five people and we put these weights and we have some sort of scientific process behind it. And then the reference checks. Are you just calling the two people that are on their list, or are you digging deeper and trying to find contacts in the industry that may know the real story to make sure that you're making the right hire, because turnover is extraordinarily expensive. So I wrote all about this in HBR, Fast Company. Those articles are on my website if people want to see more about that process.
Yeah, that's a critical one. I mean, the hiring process, we put a lot of time and effort into it. You mentioned McGough, Regina McGough, who is not the Brian McGough. She runs that process for us. And and suffice to say, first of all, she's a longstanding pro in that field, but that makes a huge difference, man.
Huge difference.
Like, you know, if you know what we're looking for and you have, like you said, a system, like if we don't have anything, we have process, right? We have a process to identify what we're looking for. And then for me, at least, I think the most critical thing is to do the final interview. I mean, mm-hmm. we have just inside of 100 employees. I do every single final interview because at least, and I'd love to get your feedback on this, the way that I've thought about this business is like a family, right? I have my family and firm, my family is my family, my firm is my family. And it's, I think that if we have a bad hire, I have to accept responsibility at some, you know, at some right at the top level for missing that in the interview, but not just missing it in the interview, but designing the process to have the interview, right? Because it should have become obvious throughout the process.
That's right.
So what do you think about that?
I absolutely love that. I mean, I have some CEOs that have 1,000, 2,000 employees that are trying to do all the interviews, and I'm talking them out of that from a scale perspective.
Yeah.
It's just hard to scale that way. But I absolutely love that you do the final interview. And I think it's absolutely critical, because all it takes is one bad hire to really drive a wedge throughout the organization. And you may not find out about it until it's too late, because it may seem like, oh, everything's fine. And then you find out 4 months later, when two other people decide to walk out the door, that person was a huge problem. And the other person didn't feel comfortable coming to you and things of that nature. So I'm fully on board with you executing the final interview for all those hires. And I hope you still do that when you're at 200, 300 people.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try. No, in fact, I have to try. I have to make time. You got to make time in your schedule. You got to empower somebody to do something. I always think about it that way. Teach people to do what you do so you could do something else, right? I mean,
exactly.
So that is one way to find the time. But if you don't want to make the time, you're going to have a shitty culture. You're going to have shitty hires. Yeah. I mean, eventually you're going to have a lot of... And actually, that is the history of the hedge fund business. I mean, look at the turnover. I mean, a lot of people, to your point, are well-known investors, but aren't well-known hirers. I mean, right. Culture fits. I mean, we have, you know, I think it would be an understatement to call analyst seats in the hedge fund community, you know, it's a generalization, which I don't always like to make, but, you know, there's a revolving door at a lot of places.
Of course.
So,
yeah, I think part of that is a hiring issue, and part of that is also flaws in leadership. I think that there are a number of people that feel like, well, I need to bark and yell and scream and be all over my people, and the fear is going to motivate them. And it actually does the opposite, because people feel like, well, you know, if this guy's going to act this way, as soon as I get my numbers up, I'm going to find a better deal, or I'm going to walk out the door. And if you feel like you need to scream and yell and bark at people to motivate them, then you have failed at hiring an A player, because an A player doesn't need that. What an A player needs is somebody who can really separate process versus outcome and understand, was this due to an unfavorable, unlucky outcome in which you need empathy? Man, I've been in your seat before. That happened to me. The best thing you could do is make like a goldfish and forget, like Ted Lasso says, and how can I help you get there? And if it's a flaw in the process, it's not berating that person. It's figuring out, you know what? I had mistakes in my process. I've gotten better over 25 years of doing it. How can I help you? Let's dig into where the mistake in the process happened, right? So that's part of it. And really also the recognition. People crave not just general thank yous and general attaboys, but specific compliments. Man, I really loved how you asked those three crucial questions of the management team that really helped us get a better understanding. And I feel like that's what allowed that to be a successful investment. And I hope you continue to do that in the future. People walk away from getting a comment like that completely fired up and loyal and wanting to go to war with a guy like that for the long term. So I think poor hiring is part of it, and leadership's another part of it.
That's a really good point on process versus outcomes. I mean, I don't know if you've read it, but Annie Duke wrote a book called Thinking in Bets, and
it's the best.
It is called Resulting, right? And she's, of course, you know, a card player. So when you play the hand that has the highest probability, and you just accept the outcome. You don't anchor
on it.
I mean,
that's right.
I think that that's I think it's a highly underestimated competitive advantage leaning on your process.
And that's right.
You can, like, if I think about my experience, like I've hired a lot of people, both, you know, on the hedge fund side as analysts and with my own fund and all that, and 15 years of doing this, making the hair go white. But it's happened where you give an A player responsibility. I mean, it's defined in our culture and in our compensation mechanism. So you can make as much as you can. There's no cap. You know, you don't get capped by what the firm made. It's generally speaking, if you're in particular a sector head or somebody like Brian McGough or any of our A players on the content side. So that's not the problem, right? But I mean, I have seen problems develop when you see somebody achieve A-type results monetarily, and it changes them. And that, from a culture perspective, there's maybe nothing worse than that.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think it's important to start off with empathy, because I feel like I'm a good person, and I had a blowout year, and I got arrogant, and I thought, oh, yeah, I know how to do this game. And then the market just punches you in the face and humbles you. And so when you're younger and you've had some success, it's very easy to think, oh, I've got this figured out. And so first empathizing and saying, yeah, I've made some mistakes like that before, and due to arrogance and things of that nature, and I matured, and here's how I'm going to help you get there. And if that person gets there, then that's tremendous personal growth. If that person stays on the other side, then that's a culture problem.
Mm-hmm. Big one. Another big problem that you write about in your book is, you know, that's a culture problem for us. An A player can develop mental health issues that you're not aware of. Now that's tough, right? Especially in this day and age. And especially when you're as tightly wound as me in terms of your daily schedule, right down to walking the dog, which is critical. Critical time. But how do you talk to and coach people through that point?
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, the first thing I say to them is, what do Miley Cyrus, Emma Stone, Kevin Love, and Michael Phelps have in common? They're all rich, good-looking, in great shape, world-class at what they do, and they've all spoken out about mental health struggles. I mean, these are people at the absolute top of their game. And the stats show that one out of every two CEOs has mental health struggles, which is something like four times the average population.
One out of two, did you say?
One out of two, right? And anxiety counts in that. Anxiety is one of the biggest ones, right? And so there's a continuum, obviously. And so I think that you have to be very aware as a leader. And there are a few things that I look for. Number one, does that person who's normally delivers you very high quality work, very productive, does it look like they're just caring less recently, or their focus really isn't there, right? And then you can sort of ask some open-ended, non-judgmental questions to try to figure out, you know, if you can coach them and help them. Or number two, you might notice that somebody is speaking in a much snarkier tone or with shorter fuses or something of that nature, where they just, their joy doesn't seem to be there anymore. Their enthusiasm doesn't seem to be there anymore. Or number three, you might notice that, yeah, I mean, we're all tired in this business, right? But just a chronic extended period of exhaustion. Those are some of the signs. And there's no harm in just calling somebody into your office and checking in, I care about you, and just asking open-ended questions. Is there anything going on that I could help you with? I want to be a sounding board. Are there any resources I could point you to? Because a lot of times it's too late. That person is then burnt out and decided I'm out. And so you need to recognize that early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awareness is a social skill that does not find its way onto your SAT score. That's actually, you know me, that's my way of explaining why I didn't have the highest SAT score at Yale. Okay. Because I have other things I'm good at, right? But I think leadership's not a given. I mean, leading a team to a championship is a really hard thing to do, and it takes actual cultural buy-in. It doesn't take all the best A players. It takes the players you have working together, does it not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, having A players helps significantly. If you have B minus C players, then that's probably going to be very hard to do. But yes, absolutely. It's inspiring people around a vision of something bigger than themselves. And I'll tell you that most mission statements and most values are terrible. They're just a bunch of fuzzy, vague buzzwords that mean nothing, and nobody knows what they are and what they represent. So actually, the chapter in my book that's gotten the strongest feedback is probably the most unique, is chapter two, the cultural bylaws. And I walk through how to design this document that's around the why are we getting up every single day and doing this? What is it exactly that we're trying to do? How are we going to get there? What are the mistakes that we've made and the lessons that we've learned so we can review before making decisions in the future and not make those same mistakes? And how do we rank our constituents? This kind of document and clarity allows you to talk to A players in the interview process about what we're all about and make them feel like you're joining something and becoming part of something bigger than yourself. And that's what people ultimately want. And it also makes it a lot easier for people, particularly in a hybrid remote world where people are spread out, to make decisions, because they know quite clearly what is our what, our why, our how, and how are our constituents ranked. And so that's one way to really get that culture all on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, in cultural bylaws, you see a staggering 61% of employees don't know what their company's mission statement is. I would be shocked. I'd have to maybe poke them a bit or lead them a bit, but If I said, what are the words transparency, accountability, and trust at Hedgeye? Where did that come from? Like that, everything we do, everything we stand for, everything we produce has to be based on those three words. So, and for me, what I love about that, and I agree, I think that chapter, really, you know, resonated quite a bit and gave me more ideas. But you started with a very good quote. If you don't mind, I'll read it so people can get it.
Yeah, cool.
And this is very well researched books, and some of the best books I've ever read always have these quotes as a lead in because you're leaning on somebody else who's taught it a different way to say the same thing, right? And this quote is, people don't buy what you do, Keith. They buy why you do it. And why you do simply proves what you believe. That is, and that's by Simon Sinek. Is he an inspirational speaker or something? It's because it's very well put.
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote a book called, I think it's called Starts With Why. And it was a game changer. It's phenomenal. Yeah, I think that's really what it's all about is somebody walks into an interview room. Why, Keith, are you getting up every day and doing this? Why are you building and growing Hedgeye? What's the point, right? And if somebody really dug into that and understood more about, you know, trying to separate yourself from the old wall and trying to help, you know, some of the folks that maybe aren't on Wall Street preserve their capital and create better memories with their family and more vacation time, that could be a hell of a selling point, right? And when you have employees that are working hard in the grind, they're already part of your company, they're working hard in the grind, and they're feeling like, man, I'm just burnt out, I'm in a tough point right now, having that why to come back to. Well, this is what Keith is inspiring us to do on a day-to-day basis. This is why we're getting up and doing this. I can't let my team down. Yes, I need to get some health and maybe take a little time away or see a coach or a therapist, but I want to get myself well so I can keep rallying and helping this team with what's bigger than me and what we're gearing for. And that's the why.
And very well put. And again, excellent chapter in the book. It could take a while, right? I mean, it could take a while because I at least would like to think that I got the walk part down, right? I may not be able to coach it perfectly every day. Like I always say, I often play the game better than I can coach it, but I'm working on that. But it could take a while for you to get your people to be the A players that are doing that. Because the goal for me isn't for them to be led just by me. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like I want them to be led by Andrew Friedman, by every single, you mentioned Brian McGough. Brian, we just went through a terrible, a tragic event with the loss of one of our partners who I think you know, Todd Jordan. And McGough stepped up like from a leadership perspective in a way that I couldn't have. I didn't go to his office and tell him to do that. But everything he did after that happened, and it was very difficult for us as a team, was to me, and I said this to him, I said, look, man, that took 15 years in the building for you to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll tell you, one of my favorite quotes of all time, this came from one of the CEOs I work with in my forum, and he's in his low 60s, empty nester, three kids out of the house, one of the best parents I've ever met. And he said, your kids listen to 10% of what you say, and they observe 100% of what you do. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that is equally true in leadership. So it starts with modeling the behavior that you want to see. And so, as you say, you walk the walk, McGough's seen that over 15 years of working with you. But then secondly, your job as CEO and as a leader is to coach your direct reports in all the principles that, like I cover in the book, of how to be a great leader. So it trickles down then throughout the organization. So then they're executing great leadership to their teams. They're coaching the people underneath them on how to be great leaders and so on. And so not only does that phenomenal leadership and culture trickle down throughout the organization, but it also makes succession planning a hell of a lot easier, not just to replace you when one day you decide to hang it up, but everyone on your team so that the junior analysts step up and become the senior analysts because internal hires are a lot less expensive and they're much better cultural fits and you want to promote from within.
Yeah, it's a... And I'm very happy that you tied that into what the gentleman said about his kids, right? Because I think of it the same way. Interestingly, maybe not ironically, given that I'm on this with McGough, and I've worked together for 15 years. We've known each other for as long as you and I and McGough knew each other, because we're on different sides of we're on different teams. But my son, my firstborn son, he's 16-year-old. I think you might know his name's Jack. I have four kids. It took the same amount of time, for, and it only happened, I think it was a couple weeks ago. I know it was a couple weeks ago. I get up, doing my thing, 4:30, 45 minutes later, like, yeah, I'm pretty in tune with the, you know, with what's going on, because nothing's going on other than me, you know, working. And I hear this click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. And now that my son has his own, has his license, like, so then he pops his head in the office. I said, what are you doing? He's like, I have a workout at 6 o'clock at Stanford Twin Rings. And I'm like, really? I said, who's scheduled that? Who's, I was more thinking, who's paying for that? And he's like, I did. This is important. You know, and that was it. It was a very quick conversation. Today, my 14-year-old daughter is, the same thing happens. And my wife had, because she's 14, my wife is driving her to a 6 a.m., you know, private workout at the rink, because her brother did it. So it's like, I can tell you right now, and I'm sure you can tell. I mean, to me, that generates more pride than any bonus I could ever earn ever again on Wall Street.
That's right. And there's so many parallels between parenting and leadership, family and leadership. And it's funny, that's why when I do coaching sessions, it usually starts off professional and it always veers into the personal. And
always, right?
You know, always, right? Because what's going on at home impacts what's going on at work. And so I'll tell you, my son is 10 and we had a lot of behavioral challenges with him over the years. And something clicked about a year ago. And it was as I was becoming more crystallized in the leadership style that I coach CEOs in terms of trusting and giving autonomy. And I started, rather than being, you know, overly controlling over the number of vegetables he eats or when he does his homework, I started saying, look, here's the evidence. I would print him out from MB. He'd stay up reading till 10 o'clock at night. And you don't want to bust your kid for reading, but you're trying to tell him you need to get a good night's sleep. And I print him out. Here's what the American Pediatrics Association says about how much sleep somebody your age needs. And I trust that you're going to make the right decision. And now he doesn't want to violate that trust. And so maybe when he's a teenager, all these parents of teenagers right now will be laughing at me at how naive that is. But it was really once I started trusting him, like I often coach CEOs to trust their C-suite and giving him more autonomy, that he responded with, wow, I want to reward him. I don't want to violate that trust. I want to show loyalty to him.
That's really cool, man. And he's still really young. I mean, that's a really powerful testament to how you raise your kids. We only have a couple minutes left here, but you know, when you look at the amount, let's put this differently. When you look at the opportunity, like, that you have here in terms of, you know, coaching, you're out there now. Finally, it's published. This has been it's essentially your life's work, right? If you didn't have your life's experiences, you wouldn't have been able to create this type of work and have the courage to set out on your own. Like, how big of an opportunity is it for everybody that's listening now? Like, I don't know if there's a scientific percentage. Like, we, you know, 61% of people don't know what their company's mission statement is. I don't know where you got that, but I'll trust he's a pretty good research analyst. I bet you that's accurate. Is there a percentage, or how would you think about the opportunity in terms of scope, not just for you as a coach, because that's your business and your passion, and it's great when your passion's your business, but what percentage of people get up every day running businesses that just don't even talk about this or address it at all?
That's right. I think it's an extremely high percentage. And I think that, yes, extremely high percentage. And I think that whether you run a massive organization or you're a first-time manager and you have one person underneath you, virtually everything that I talk about in the book is going to be applicable to you. And I want to make sure before we leave that I open up about, I had anxiety for the first 40 some odd years of my life. And I was lucky that it was usually mild, but sometimes it was pretty tough. And I open up about it in chapter 5. But I want to make sure people understand a couple things that really helped me get over it. And I think can help you if you have experienced that. And if you haven't, to understand for your A players that may be experiencing that. And that is, if you get up every single day and you approach what you do in a kind and honest and high integrity manner, and you attack your work with a meticulous process that's repeatable, should significantly help you reduce the amount of anxiety that you have, like it had with me, because you've done everything in your control to do the right thing and maximize your odds of success. And that's the most important message I could give.
Reducing, like you said, that was a big number, like 1 out of 2. I can even get to the probability of that. Of CEOs, they're real. I mean, this anxiety is something that few would. I guess I'm on the other half. And that's why people, like I said, probably recommend that I get therapy. But because I generally just don't have anxiety. I think I've been punched in the face or blocked too many shots, pucks to the head, and otherwise. I actually did take one right off the top of the head once where it split the top of my head open. I mean, so maybe that's what happened. I don't know what causes that, but I don't have, like, that's not an issue for me. But you're saying it's a real issue that a lot of people, you know, may not be willing to admit, and they should find solutions for it.
That's right. I would be willing to bet, however big your senior leadership team is, maybe at least a third of them have experienced some level of mental health struggles, whether it's anxiety, depression, or things of that nature. And I think historically, our parents' generation, it was sweep it under the rug, right? Oh, yeah. You got to look tough. But if you truly want to be the best at your job, the best significant other, and the best parent, then getting over that hump and allowing yourself to be vulnerable and seeking out a resource is so fundamentally important and one of the single best things you could possibly do in your life.
Well, with that, you know, our time's up, but I actually have, I mean, I knew I was going to get a lot of a real conversation with Ryan Renteria, to be clear. I didn't know where it was going to go, and I'm happy. That's for me, that's why I love these conversations, is that there's a curiosity and there's an adventure about it. But the take, like, my company we need to establish some type of mental health resource that's at a much higher, an open-ended level for my teammates in case they're going through that. It's a great example, right, Ryan, where I just said, I'm just, for whatever reason, pucks to the head. I don't have a lot of anxiety, but my teammates do. Some of them do, definitely. So let's create an opportunity for them to find some solutions for that. So, as always, thank you so much. You're a bright light that came out of Wall Street, man. And while I criticize Wall Street plenty, the old wall fully loaded. You know, there are a lot of people that leave the old wall and go achieve and create, you know, other and great things. And a lot of people on Wall Street that continue to achieve and create great things. So thanks for having the courage to do that and for spending some time with me.
Thank you so much, Keith. I really appreciate it.
He's Ryan Renteria. So we've gone back to back here. If you make it 3 for 3 and then 6 for 6, I'm impressed. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the Hedgeye Investing Summit, featuring conversations with some of the sharpest minds in investing. To get access to the other 8 Hedgeye Investing Summit conversations and for more great investing content, go to Hedgeye.com.
Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.